Hello and welcome back to Chris and Reggie's Cosmic Treadmill, episode number 68, where we go back to the past and read a comic book from the yesteryear of publishing. You can find us every Sunday on chrisandreggie.podbean.com and pick us up from iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, iHeartRadio, and from the depths of blazing hot hell. This is where if I had a soundboard, there would definitely be a thunder crash, right?
Yes.
Today, we are plugging in one of my personal gaps, and definitely a gap in the show, to read Spawn number 1 from 1992. This would be the last of the Image launch titles from 92 that we're reviewing. That existed, but not in order. Not in order of release, but as you put it, I think.
In reverse order of quality.
Exactly. And that's kind of the best way to do it. You know, we started with, we'll talk about later what we started with, what we ended with. But I had a good time with this. For Chris, this was going back to an old flavor ice cream he used to like a lot. And for me, it was like a brand new flavor from 1992 that I was like, people ate this. They ate bubble gum and flavor ice or whatever. You know, whatever crazy extreme flavors. Anyway, the book is Spawn number 1, cover date May 1992, written, penciled, and inked by Todd McFarlane, colored by Steve Olaf, Ken Stacey, and Ruben Rude, lettered by Tom Orzechowski, cover by Todd McFarlane and Ken Stacey, and the cover price is $1.95 USD.
Now, as we always do, let's talk Todd. He was born March 16th, 1961 in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. He has two brothers. His father worked in printing, which required the family to move wherever work was. So they'd scoot around a bit. Actually, more than a bit. Todd lived at 30 different addresses during his childhood, from Alberta to all the way to California, which that might explain the accent I always think of for him.
Yeah,
I always think it's
like California.
It's sort of Canadian, Canada, sort like, of ca- or like sort a, of like Californian.
It's like a Canadian trying to do a Californian accent. But yeah, I mean, everywhere in between and back again from what I read. I mean, it wasn't just a continuous nomadic line. It was really jumping around the map of
like Washington
America.
State and
right.
all over. Yeah.
Everywhere.
Now, he began drawing at an early age, which... I guess a lot of the artists we've covered do, because not many of them get that itch at like 45 being like, hey, maybe I can draw a comic.
I don't want to draw comics now.
Now, he became a fan of comics, particularly those drawn by John Byrne and George Perez. So that tells you about the era that he was becoming a fan in. He would attend the Sir Winston Churchill High School in Alberta. He created the character Spawn when he was 16 and spent, quote, countless hours perfecting the appearance of each component of the character's visual design. I remember watching on the Stan Lee interview show that they released on VHS back in the day, where he said like he'd spend a whole day drawing a thumb until it was perfect, and then the whole day drawing an eyebrow until it was perfect.
Yeah, that's a little Michelangelo for you, but I don't know.
That's what he said.
The work is good. Not sure if it bears that kind of scrutiny out, but anyway, we'll let him go with that.
We'll allow it. Right after high school, McFarlane attended baseball tryouts at Gonzaga University, a Jesuit school in Spokane, Washington. Though he was good enough on the field, he wasn't good enough at bat to make the team. To make matters worse, he also couldn't afford Gonzaga, so he wound up going to Spokane Community College for a couple of years.
Yeah, much worse sounding named college. In 1981, McFarlane began attending Eastern Washington University on a baseball scholarship, studying graphics and art. His practical goal was to join his father in the printing business in Calgary, though his dream was always to be a comic book creator and also to play baseball professionally, apparently. Going through the years of Todd McFarlane's interviews, he's going to say the same thing twice. He changed his mind along the way. But apparently he definitely did, along with an on-campus job and his normal studies, Todd also worked weekends at a comic shop called The Comic Rec, devoting a couple of hours late at night to practice his comics art. A serious ankle injury in his junior year during a game with arch rivals Washington State University imperiled his dreams of playing professional baseball. After this, he concentrated all of his efforts on his artwork, took a full-time job at the Comic Rec, and moved into a trailer park in Cheney, Washington with his high school girlfriend, Wanda. Remember that name. In 1984, a year after his injury, McFarland's final chance to play for the big leagues came when he tried out with the Toronto Blue Jays farm team in Medicine Hat, Alberta, but ended up being ranked last on the roster, ending his professional baseball prospects. McFarland graduated with a bachelor's degree that same year and stayed in Spokane while his girlfriend finished college. While still in college, McFarland began sending 30 to 40 packages of submissions each month to comics editors, totaling over 700 submissions after a year and a half. About half of them got rejection letters, some with advice. Other half received no response, and I don't really blame the people that were getting them. Sure. DC Comics, Sal Amendola, he is an Italian-born artist known primarily for his work in horror comics like The Witching Hour at the time and, House of Secrets, gave McFarlane a dummy script in order to gauge McFarlane's page-to-page storytelling ability. Amendola's advice was that McFarlane's submissions needed to focus on page-to-page stories rather than pinups, and that led McFarlane to create a five-page coyote sample.
Yeah, and Coyote was a cell phone comic by Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers that was published by Marvel's Epic imprint at the time. Then it would continue on at Eclipse Comics. Todd sent his pages to Uncanny X-Men editor Ann Nocenti at Marvel Comics, who would pass them along to Archie Goodwin and Joe Duffy. They were the editors of the Epic imprint at the time. They in turn passed it over to Coyote creator Steve Englehart, who called McFarlane to offer him his first comic gig, a backup story in Coyote number 11, covered it in March 1985. McFarlane soon began drawing it for both DC and Marvel, with his first major body of work being a two-year run from 85 through 87 on DC's Infinity Incorporated. Then in 1987, McFarlane illustrated the latter three issues of Detective Comics' four-issue Batman Year 2 storyline, written by Mike Baugh. He would also do the art for the first two parts of the 1989 Invasion event.
That's right. I almost forgot all about that. But
easy one to forget about.
He sort of defined the look of the Dominators, right?
Of the Dominators.
In my mind, mm-hmm. Definitely, they're McFarlane Dominators, yeah.
They look venomous almost,
yeah.
With the mouths.
For sure.
Now, Todd would move on to Marvel's Incredible Hulk, which he would draw from 87 to 88, working with writer Peter David. McFarlane joined David Michelinie on Marvel's Amazing Spider-Man, beginning with issue number 298 that was cover dated March 1988. He would enlarge the eyes on Spider-Man's mask and draw a unique sort of corded webbing that would get him some notice. A lot of folks refer to this webbing as spaghetti webbing. And these the poses he put Spider-Man in were very dynamic, too, if not anatomically possible.
Yeah, some of those squats were a little extreme, but
Little rib removal.
A little bit of that going on. A lot of twisting in the air, but definitely a huge shift in just the way people perceive Spider-Man.
And he evoked the spider, so it was
very much so.
Neat.
I remember, for me, first of all, the webbing was huge, because before that, it was just two lines and
cross-hatching.
So that was like, oh, wow, this looks like something with heft. But it was the hoisted, the twisting himself in the air, just something seemed very suddenly it seemed, I don't know, like more real. Like this is what you would be. You'd be thrusting yourself through the air.
Sure.
So again, you kind of had to be there, but take our word for it. It really was like a big shift in the way people perceive Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I mean, McFarlane was also the first artist to draw the first full appearance of Eddie Brock, the original incarnation of the villain Venom. He's named as the co-creator of the character, though it is disputable. In Wizard magazine number 17, that was a January 1993 cover date, David Michelinie is listed as the co-creator of Venom. In his letter, which was printed in issue 21, May of that same year, Michelinie wrote that he was the character's sole creator, but also stated that he believed without McFarlane, the character would not have attained the popularity it did. So,
duh.
Fair enough, yeah. Frankly, I wish there were more arrangements like that in comics, but here we are.
Sure.
Working on Amazing Spider-Man made Todd McFarlane a superstar. His cover for Amazing Spider-Man number 313, that was March 1989, for which he was originally paid $700 in 1989, for example, would later sell for $71,200 in 2010.
Wow.
A nice jump up. Nice. If you had mm-hmm. that, graded and slabbed, you were very happy. Mm-hmm. Todd became increasingly dissatisfied with the lack of control over his own work. He wanted more say in the direction of storylines. He began to miss some deadlines, requiring fill and artists to pitch in. In 1990, after a 28-issue run of Amazing Spider-Man, McFarlane told editor Jim Salicrup that he wanted to write his own stories and would be leaving the book with issue number 328. That was a January 1990 cover, which was part of that year's company-wide Acts of Vengeance crossover storyline. In July 2012, the original artwork to that issue's cover, which features Spider-Man dispatching the Hulk, sold for a record-breaking $657,250.
This over a half million dollars.
It's the highest auction price ever for any piece of American comic book art.
Wow.
Over everybody, you know, that's unbelievable. McFarlane was succeeded on Amazing Spider-Man by McFarlane's future fellow Image Comics co-founder and Savage Dragon creator Eric Larson. Now, wanting to appease McFarlane, Marvel offered McFarlane a new adjectiveless Spider-Man title for McFarlane to both write and draw. Spider-Man number one, August 1990 cover, sold 2.5 million copies. Though it is fair to say it had quite a robust program of variant covers, I think
that it did. Yeah,
I think I counted at least like 6 to 8, and I think I might have not even seen all of the ones that were available.
Sure.
McFarlane, unbeknownst to his parents at the time, was making about $1 million a year. He wrote and illustrated 15 of the series' first 16 issues, many of which featured other popular Marvel characters such as Wolverine and Ghost Rider in guest roles.
Now, some reception to the series was negative, particularly among Marvel's talent and staffers. It was a much darker take on Spidey. It dealt with themes like police corruption, child rape, and murder. Yeah, there was the like an ice cream man or something.
Yeah.
McFarlane had editor Jim Salicrup enact his costume design changes, including the spaghetti webbing, line-wide. He was also increasingly late on the series, requiring Eric Larson to fill in on issue number 15. That was October 1991. Todd's final issue was 16, the November of 1991 issue, and that began a crossover with X-Force, another huge title at the time. And this led to disagreements between Todd and ex-editor Danny Fingeroth. According to McFarlane and editor Tom DeFalco in the 2000 documentary, The Devil You Know, Inside the Mind of Todd McFarlane, among the examples of the issues that prompted his departure were editorial censorship of a panel in that issue in which the character Juggernaut was graphically stabbed in the eye with a sword. That's necessary. DeFalco supported the editing of the panel, calling it inappropriate, while McFarlane called this lunacy.
I gotta say, it is unnecessary. I do think it's over the top to stab someone through the eye with a sword in a,
sure,
in a mainstream comic, but it was not beyond what was going on in comics at the time at all. You know, that would have been pretty tame compared to some of the things I remember seeing on the stands. But anyway.
But then you're left with a one-eyed Juggernaut.
That was a problem, yeah.
What do you do with it? Todd would wind up leaving Marvel under something of a cloud. According to David Wallace of Comics Bulletin, he says, McFarlane's 15 issues of Spider-Man are now, perhaps slightly unfairly, held up alongside the likes of X-Force as the epitome of everything that was wrong with 1990s comics and their cash-in approach to the then-booming speculative market precipitated the near collapse of the industry. And then this happened.
That's right. We've talked about this before. We'll talk about it again. That Todd, along with six contemporaries who we have named before, left Marvel. And I always forget Silvestri, but I didn't. That's the only one I'll name this time. But they left Marvel in 1992 to start their own publishing imprint. This would afford them creative control and rights for their own properties. So most importantly, all the financial benefits that come with ownership. This was the Image Comics revolution, and each creator had his own imprint, which would use Image for distribution, publicity, and manufacturing, but otherwise be on its own for creative and production needs. Todd McFarlane Productions published his creation, the occult-themed Spawn, written and drawn by McFarlane. This was Image's second release, following the release of Rob Liefeld's Youngblood, so I guess that was the big boom, and actually this comic ends up referencing Youngblood twice in it, but yes. it's fun. Upon its release in 1992, Spawn number one, May 1992 cover, sold 1.7 million copies, still a record for an independent comic book.
That's wild.
Wow.
For more of our thoughts on the Image Comics launch, you can check out episode 22, where we discuss Youngblood number one, episode 28, where we discuss Wildcats number one, and episode 46, where we discuss Savage Dragon number one. All of those are available in the archives.
That's right. This is going to be our Image Comics Quadfecta. If that's, I don't believe that's a word, but that's fine.
It is now.
So let's jump into that sweet issue, Spawn number one from 1992. This is titled Questions Part One. Cover features, you know, Spawn. He's a pretty basic action pose. Sort of looks like he's maybe a little bit of Doctor Strange, a little bit of Spider-Man going on in there, right?
I think yes.
His right hand is surrounded by a glowing green power. Also, I got to mention, there's a lot of well-rendered, carefully rendered chains on his costume. Mm-hmm. You know, this was not, definitely not what we would have thought of at the time as a superhero costume, but it is now. You know, I'll tell you
what. Yeah, totally.
Part of because of this. Of the cover, Todd recalls, I was looking for a cover design that was simple. Because to me, the books that stand out the most are the ones with a simple cover.
Well, that could probably be an episode unto itself, you know, the merits of the pinup cover.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
Now, of the classic Spawn logo, this is that one with the cartoony skull inside the A, he says, I wanted a logo that was easily recognizable, so I sat with Tom Wojciechowski, who's been lettering the book since inception, and still is, and gave him an updated design of the original Spawn logo I created when I was 16 years old.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, Orzechowski is a veteran letterer. Probably most famous for editing the X-Men line through much of the 80s. He pretty much created that squat font, you know, that's like so indicative of that. But
the one that fits Claremontian bubbles.
Essentially, the harmonious lettering and writing duo of Claremont and Orzechowski. But we were even saying before the show, the logo looks really good. The Spawn logo
really
looks
sharp,
super professional and sharp, and definitely does what it's supposed to do. The inside front cover features a dedication to Jack Kirby, which feels a little bit dubious, sort of like a stick it to the man move from Todd and the gang toward Marvel, which is fair enough, but as an attempt to show solidarity with legendary slighted artist, it feels kind of laughable, right? This is a little too on the nose. Also, like, you know, this comic doesn't share a ton of immediate DNA with Jack Kirby, you know, probably more with Bernie Wrightson or something like that. But anyway, the Image guys were compensated far better than the King Kirby ever was. So
We just said that Todd was making $1 million a year.
Yeah, I don't think Jack Kirby ever made $1 million a year.
I don't think so either. Yeah.
Anyway.
Now, the issue itself opens with a monologue that doesn't use the word advantageous at all.
Spawn says, I don't belong. Not here. Not now. I have to get back there.
And we can see the Earth. The camera eventually zooms in on the city.
The bet was rigged. He made me believe. Now there's darkness in my soul. I want to die. Again.
We zoom in closer. Atop a church, a caped man broods.
But I chose to come back. Why?
We cut away to various news reports from 1987. We're going to use a lot of the notes from the recently released Director's Cut edition of Spawn No. 1, celebrating the 25th anniversary. In it, Todd refers to this as a, quote, reporter page, which is good a name as any, right?
There are reporters on it, so.
There are reporters on it. It feels very much like he's taking a page from the Frank Miller playbook here.
Do you think so? Maybe.
However, he never mentions Miller in the director's cut. It's kind of like it was his idea all along.
Yeah, don't know. You know, I mean, to be fair, Miller wasn't the one first come up with it. But yeah, this is a little on the nose. It looks a little like one of those Dark Knight Returns pages, but
just a touch.
That's fine. We meet three reporters who still pop up in Spawn comics. The first is an Asian woman who for the moment works for CNN with the actual CNN logo behind her, which I was pretty surprised
Weird,
to
right?
see. I was like, oh, okay, suddenly this is a real thing. The second is a heavyset older white man with a beard, which sort of looks like a flabby Santa Claus. He's reporting from Channel 2, and Todd describes him as a bad version of Rush Limbaugh, a hot maverick combination of these type of guys who do talk radio. The third is an effeminate entertainment news reporter currently in this scene on Channel 7. The news of the day is the funeral services for Colonel Al Simmons. We learn that Simmons was survived by his wife, Wanda Blake.
Wanda?
Yeah, that name. Where did I hear that name before? The monologue continues. We see a young black soldier. The next pages are on a 9-panel grid, something Todd calls a grid pattern.
Wow, that's a clever name for it.
Yeah, he thought it up all by himself. Isn't that something?
I've never heard that before. I've never watched for anything like that, man.
Man. Anywho, the soldier was turned on by one of his own, Was turned on by one of his own. The only thing he can recall is the sight of a skull. Though he does remember dying.
Chapel, my man. He also remembers a beautiful woman.
Oh, God. She's so beautiful.
And a demon.
I need it. He gave.
And a sort of rebirth.
I had to. All I could think of was her. So I promised, and he accepted. All because of her.
Now, it's pretty clear that this deal might not have gone, been a fair one for our man.
But did Aunt May survive? That's all that matters. Is she all right?
She did. Okay. Whew. Now, the spawn suggests that this demon is off somewhere, busting a gut laughing. And it's here that we first see the power meter. An hourglass shatters and a timer ticks down. This is going to be a theme in early Spawn comics. There's a timer ticking down. And it starts at 9:09:09:09. Per Todd, this is where I stopped being, quote, bland and really got into the artistic stuff people were expecting from me based off the artwork they'd seen on Spider-Man.
That's right. We all were waiting to see that countdown clock.
That's where it stopped being bland.
He broke free of the constraints, anyway. What follows is our first in-book shot of Spawn, and it's a really great splash page.
It is.
It's pretty iconic, and in fact, you could even kind of say it essentially looks like a Batman, you know, Spawn in a Batman pose or whatever, but it, yep. It looks terrific. I've not much more to say, but you do get a good look at his costume. Mm-hmm. Sort of has like a luchador, has like a reverse Spider-Man mask on top of like a Captain Britain costume with chains. He's got pouches around a leg. It's got everything you want to see in 1992.
Everything you want.
So bless his heart. The demon gave Spawn his powers, but robbed him of his memories. He knows he needs to find that beautiful woman. He's sure she'll help him remember everything. Per Todd, he said, I wanted to unveil Spawn. I knew this was going to be an iconic moment in Spawn's mythology.
Spawn's mythology is 6 pages at this point.
Yeah, and he wanted to seize the opportunity for an epic reveal.
Now we shift scenes and meet detectives Sam and Twitch.
Sam and Twitch would be a mainstay in the Spawn books and would eventually get their own spin-off title, which would be one of the first high-profile gigs in comics for Brian Michael Bendis. Mm. And if Todd's notes are to be believed, an upcoming television show.
How about that?
I will tune in when that shows up, folks. They're at a crime scene where a man was tossed out a window.
Yeah, Sam goes, okay, Twitch, let's try this one more time. You're telling me that somebody threw Carlo Giamatti from a window?
Through a window, sir.
Through a window on the 34th floor?
44th, sir.
And he wasn't killed by the fall?
No, sir. It was his heart.
Heart failure?
You might say that, sir. It was removed.
Removed?
Yes, sir. It was stuffed in his mouth.
That's pretty hardcore.
Yikes.
Now, back in the alleys, Spawn stops an attempted gang rape. And these guys get uncomfortably far along with it, too.
Yeah, a little bit too far, but
tearing the clothes off and everything, yeah.
Spawn does show up in time and says, get out now, or you're all dead.
A dude named Shank goes, what the hell?
And a guy that's not named Shank says, hey, Shank, looks like one of them young bloods.
If only, right? Now Spawn beats the hell out of the would-be rapists. And when he sees the attacked woman, he flashes back to a vision of a skull, and he begins to freak out. He thinks of the beautiful woman from earlier, and the flashback melds into a scene from Al Simmons' funeral service. The same beautiful woman is there, dressed in appropriate funeral attire. Her face suddenly morphs into that of Venom, basically. Right. A lot of pointy teeth and a very long tongue.
Spawn, wait, and this is right here, one of the most touching and funny scenes, is Spawn waking up in the arms of an attacked woman sobbing, and she's soothing him. She's like, there, and it's just like,
yes.
Like, what happened? Well, you know, the tables have turned. She was like, well, I didn't get raped, so I can help this horrifying masked man in chains and spikes. Yes. Anyway, that's New York for you, folks. Next up is another reporter page, now featuring news from the present day, that is to say, 1992 present day, not today. Though we see those same 3 reporters, their looks have changed just a little bit, illustrating the passage of time. Asian woman now has a short haircut, still works for CNN, the logo has changed position. The Limbaugh alike has a receding hairline, still on Channel 2. And the entertainment guy now has a thin mustache and reports from E! Entertainment Television, again, with the actual logo. I don't know how he...
Weird, right?
I guess it's fair use. I don't really understand how you can just get away with that, but fine.
Even in the reprints, it's weird.
Very, I mean, yeah, I guess because, I don't know. I'm not enough of a lawyer or at all a lawyer to tell why that is okay, but fine.
Hey, I'm used to like WGBS or whatever, right, the Lex Luthor.
Like even if it was CMN, you know, or you know what I mean, some nonsense, but it's the exact right thing.
It's pretty crazy. Now, these the reporters are speaking of the recent rash of gangland murders, Carlo Giamatti being the latest casualty. And they also discuss a new mystery man.
That's right. The E! Entertainment Television caster says, "And finally, a word out of New York is that there's a new mystery man in the Big Apple. Only a handful of reports so far, but from what I can tell, our big bruiser has a fetish for Zorro. I mean, let's get serious. A cape with the Youngblood fashions being all the rage. Why on earth would anyone try to bring back such a gauche and totally useless accessory? Now those spikes and chains he has, those are simply darling. A perfectly riveting statement."
They are pretty darling. Now, for Spawn being a mystery man, they've got a whole lot of eyewitness details about him, right?
This is a lot of down to the chains and spikes.
He has brown eyes.
Yeah. We know nothing about him, though.
Now, speaking of our mystery man, we rejoin Spawn as he ambles down the alley, still lamenting his lack of memory. He pulls away at his face mask and gloves, revealing the scary hamburger meat underneath.
"I know I'm alive, but I can't feel it. Only thing I feel is this damn costume. Got to get it off. Get away from it. My face felt like... Jesus, what am I?"
And he slumps down among the garbage and cries.
Now we pop back over to Sam and Twitch, who are reading some notes on a very powerful vigilante, someone they consider to be a serious problem. The Spawn power meter now reads 9995. And we close out the demon Spawn made the arrangement with, laughing.
Yes, we're going to call him the Violator, because that's what his name is.
Well, we find that out later, I assume, yeah.
He says, "Simmons, if you think you've got problems now, I promise your troubles have just begun."
I mean, literally, it's the first issue, and that is the end of the first issue. Let's talk about it a little bit, like I say, for me, and I said this too before the show to Chris, I'm pretty sure I flipped through this issue. I remember there's a scene you see Spawn in the very beginning. I remember the Dark Knight ripoffs of the cover with the lightning. Mm-hmm. I definitely remember some of the scenes. I also may have just... over the years seen shots of it. It really is an iconic issue, but this is the first time I sat with it, and frankly, like all of the Image launches, just way better than I expected. And this really is the best one. This is a pretty well told story. I wouldn't call it chock full, as you notice we kind of blasted through the script pretty quickly.
It was and we included a lot of the dialogue.
He included a lot of there's just not a lot to say. This is definitely the artist, artist, writer, whatever, and the art tells a lot of the story, but it's really well polished, and it looks like a totally 100% professional comic book that could stand, you know, toe to toe with any DC or Marvel, definitely any Marvel on the stands at the time. But for you, this was kind of early in your comic collecting too, wasn't it?
It was, and this is actually one of the first times I actually bit on the Speculator thing. I think I don't remember what episode I talked about this on, but me and my friend weren't going to get this issue, but when we got to the store that day, there was a dude trying to buy every single issue in the store. So we grabbed one each just in case, and I don't think I read it. I think it was just like, I flipped through it because it's really a very pretty book. It's a gorgeous book. But I don't think I read it until several years later.
Interesting.
I still bought a Spawn on occasion. I just, it wasn't a regular.
Interesting. I thought you were I thought you walked in and the guy said, "It's Toad McFarlane, bro." You know, and you were like, "Oh, all right."
$8? Okay, whatever. But it was never one that I loved or hated. It was just one that that I'd grab on occasion and never really kept up with. And even I'm trying to think of the last time I read it before for the show. I think I read it had to be I got that compendium last year. That was probably when I last read this issue. And this time, you know, we're talking about how it's these are better than we expected. And even just reading the Sam and Twitch scene, it's like this dialogue isn't bad.
It really isn't bad. You know, it's a funny scene. You know, it doesn't sound unnatural. You know, it's meant to be there. It's kind of meant to play up as a joke. So that's why.
Yeah, over the top jokey.
They have that. They have that back and forth. But it really, you're right. It isn't bad. And, you know, I just have been kind of trained mentally to expect less, and I guess that's
exactly same here.
That's a good thing because then you're pleasantly surprised when you get to it. I would really say anybody who is interested in, you know, 90s comics, and like anything else in the world, you have to take this in context.
Of course,
this would not, you know, I know Spawn sells today or is on the stands today, but this would not make the same splash today. It's just different sensibilities, different things going on in the world. But if you look at it in the context of what it was, which would be extreme foodstuffs, like I was talking about earlier, and stuff, you know what I mean? The whole world surrounding it, the kind of like whips and chains, and you know, a sort of an edginess. I mean, this is right on the cusp of Nirvana, right? Taking off and taking music back from glam metal or whatever. It's cool. I really dug it, and you can get it digitally on the Image site, or I don't know, through Comixology, definitely through the Image app.
Sure,
I recommend it. I had a good time with it. You do have a unbroken run now, though, right? Or is that a
it's almost unbroken. It's almost unbroken. Yeah, I've got a few that I'm still trying to track down, but I've got the lion's share of them. And if I wanted to sit down and read through it, I don't think I would miss a whole lot from what I'm missing.
Probably not. Well, actually, as we go into it, we'll see that the story is not exactly linear. It sort of jumps around a little bit, but yeah, let's wrap up with a little bit some more info about Spawn and Todd. So responding to his harsh criticism of abilities as a writer for Spawn, McFarlane hired acclaimed writers to guest write Spawn issues 8 through 11, including Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, Dave Sim, and Frank Miller. You will hear some of those names again later. Mm-hmm. Subsequent writers he would hire on the series included Grant Morrison, Andrew Grossberg, and letterer Tom Orzechowski, so that was cool. Greg Capullo penciled several issues as a guest artist and became the regular penciler with issue number 26. That was the December 1994 cover. McFarlane remained as the writer and inker until issue number 70, February 1998. In 1993, Wizard declared Spawn the best-selling comic on a consistent basis that is currently being published. Maybe a little early. A year into the run, but that's fine.
It's like this is the highest grossing movie released on a Tuesday. Right. It was snowing in three quarters.
How can we narrow the parameters, get it like up into number one? But anyway, Spawn is notable for being one of the only two Image books that debuted during the company's 1992 rebirth, along with Eric Larson's Savage Dragon, that continues to be published well into the late 2010s. I think there is a Youngblood series that just started coming out, but I still would say there's been a long gulf in between the last Youngblood.
Yeah, and they restarted that with a one, so.
Exactly, so there you go. Yeah, it actually does get a volume two. Before the big two, of course, went all legacy number crazy in recent years, Spawn would have the highest numbered books on the racks.
Which is insane.
It's crazy to think about, you know, that it was beating out books that were 70 years older, but whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yep, Spawn was the highest numbered book. I think it's in the 270s right now. So in the next couple of years, it's going to break Dave Sim's Cerebus record. So
wow. And Savage Dragon's up there, too. I mean, that's no slouch
either. Savage Dragon's around 230, yeah. Wow. So it's they're way up there. Now, Todd has had some run-ins with famous folks, some folks in the comics industry and outside the comics industry. But some of these we've discussed
everywhere
before.
Everywhere he goes, he likes to leave little Todd wherever he is.
Yes. Now, first, we're going to talk about Todd versus Peter David. Now, during Image's early years of operation, the company was subject to much industry criticism over aspects of his business practices, including shipping books late and its creators' emphasis of art over writing. Now, one of those critics was McFarlane's former Hulk collaborator, the writer Peter David. This came to a head during a public debate they participated in at Philadelphia's Comic Fest convention in October 1993, which was moderated by artist George Perez. McFarlane stated that Image was not being treated fairly by the media, and by Peter David in particular. The three judges, Maggie Thompson of the Comics Buyer's Guide, William Christensen of Wizard Press, and John Danovic of the magazine Hero Illustrated voted 2-1 in favor of David, with Danovic voting the debate as a tie.
Yeah, quite a vote there, Danovic. But anyway,
after this is the one that he came out like dressed like a prize fighter, right?
Oh yeah. Peter David had some choice words for this debate, which that he wrote in Comics Buyer's Guide number 1043. That was November 12, 1993, when it was issued. He wrote, "A day or so after I had accepted Todd's challenge, I was contacted by the Comic Fest folks with the question as to what the debate should be called. They told me Todd's suggestions were along the lines of the Scholar versus the Holler, and David and Goliath, and so on. Putting aside how David versus Goliath originally ended, I told Comic Fest 93 that those titles were wildly inappropriate and unacceptable. A topic would have to be discussed, and no, it couldn't be. Why is Peter David telling lies about us? Because that automatically puts me on the defensive. Considering that was the subtext of the whole thing anyway, I was already feeling defensive enough as it was. Besides, a debate resolution is supposed to be phrased as neutrally as possible. So I suggested, resolved, Image Comics, have they received fair treatment from the media? Todd subsequently agreed to this with the modification of Image Todd McFarlane, as a one unit. Imagine my surprise when a couple of weeks later I see ads starting to surface featuring all the rejected titles, plus more. A circus mentality was shaping up with which I did not want to be associated. It was at that point I insisted on a more structured, formal presentation before the thing denigrated into a farce. Bad luck for Todd, really. If he hadn't run those ads and tipped his hand early as to what sort of spin he was planning to put on it, I very likely would not have urged greater structure to the proceedings. You see, the problem when you realize you're getting into a mud wrestling match is it doesn't matter who wins. You wind up covered with mud no matter what you do."
It's true.
Yep.
Now, in 1994, McFarlane and DC Comics collaborated on an intercompany crossover, each producing a book featuring Batman and Spawn. The first of the two books, Batman Spawn War Devil, March 1994, was written by Doug Mensch, Chuck Dixon, and Alan Grant, and drawn by Klaus Janson, and published by DC. That would be followed by Spawn Batman, April 1994, which was written by Frank Miller and drawn by McFarlane and put out through Image.
What an amazing roster of talent, too.
It's indeed.
It's like every great writer at the time on Batman showed up for that one. Now, over time, Todd McFarlane was less hands-on with Spawn. He would hire other writers such as Brian Holguin and David Hein, and artists such as Wilson Potasio, Angel Medina, Philip Tan, and Simon Kredrensky. He would offer story input and notes, and he did ink some covers still. In 1994, McFarlane created a toy company, Todd Toys, initially to a merchandise collectible action figures of the Spawn characters. In 3 months, the company sold more than 2.2 million of the action figures nationwide.
Wild.
They did eventually change the name. We'll get into that. We're going into a lot more detail about this later after we talk about McFarlane. In 1996, McFarlane founded Todd McFarlane Entertainment, a film and animation studio. In collaboration with New Line Cinema, it produced the 1997 Spawn film. While this was critically panned, Spawn was a modest box office success, earning $54.8 million domestically and almost $33 million worldwide against a $40 million budget. Not bad.
Good. Yeah, good thing there was no Twitter at the time.
Or Rotten Tomatoes would have tanked or whatever.
Now, Todd McFarlane Entertainment also produced the animated series, Todd McFarlane Spawn. This featured the voice work by actor Keith David, and this aired on HBO from 1997 until 1999. Ed Bach of the Dallas Morning News called the series a, quote, "very unpleasant viewing experience." And then he asked, "Why anyone would want to subject themselves to such a relentlessly grim, gruesome, dehumanizing experience?" The animated series won a 1998 Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Achievement in Animation.
So stick that in your craw there, Ed Bark. Yeah, I remember Bark. It was really well animated.
It was.
I don't actually remember the stories too well, but I do remember seeing a little bit and thinking this was also around the time of stuff like Aeon Flux.
A lot of good animation. Much like a music video, yeah.
Yeah, very much like that, yeah.
Now, in 1998, Todd paid $2.6 million at auction for the baseball that St. Louis Cardinals first baseman Mark McGuire hit for his then-record-breaking 70th home run. He also spent $175,000 for Sammy Sosa's 66th home run ball. Todd would sporadically return as the interior artist on Spawn for intermittent issues, and for a few years wrote it under a pseudonym, Will Carlton, in order to generate interest in the book by fostering the illusion that a new talent was being brought to the book's production. McFarlane produced Spawn Batman Inner Demons in December 2006, along with artist Greg Capullo, and Todd wrote and inked that. This was another special tribute to Jack Kirby. Somehow.
Yeah. Where does Jack Kirby and Batman intersect? We're not sure, but okay.
Yeah. Fair enough. Now, that same year, McFarlane started to concentrate on publishing trade collections of Spawn. Spawn Collection Volume 1 collected the first 12 issues, minus 9, due to royalty issues with Neil Gaiman, more on that in a bit, and 10, due to a vow he made to Dave Sim, more on that in a little bit. This would be released, the trade collection would be released in December of 2005.
Yeah, it just shows you how the industry has changed when that was not even a thought until the 2000s, you know, after yep. the comic's already been out for, you know, 13 years. Now, we're going to do our best here, folks, to tell you a little bit about Todd McFarlane versus Neil Gaiman. In Spawn issue number 9, that was a March 1993 cover date, Neil Gaiman introduced new characters Angela, Medieval Spawn, and Count Nicholas Cogliostro. In 1997, the two signed a deal that would be Neil and Todd, in which Gaiman would give his share of the characters to McFarlane in exchange for McFarlane's share of British superhero Marvel Man.
Now, it was actually much more complicated than this. So complicated that we'll be dealing with the whole Magilla in an upcoming episode of Weird Comics
right.
History.
But those are promise. That's the basics of it, right? That's essentially the short version.
Now, this deal was broken by McFarlane in quite a humorous way, which we will get to in that next episode.
Yeah.
This was very complicated. So in 2002, Neil Gaiman sued Todd McFarlane, and a federal jury unanimously found that Gaiman was co-copyright holder of these characters. Meanwhile, Gaiman asked for a trial on the issue of three characters from the 1999 crossover series, Spawn the Dark Ages, that ran 28 issues from March 1999 through October 2001. Gaiman testified that he thought the Dark Ages characters in question were imitations of his past creations. In 2010, a federal judge agreed and said Gaiman was entitled to half the profits. Reportedly, Gaiman has given his money to comics charities. There was that whole to-do with Miracle Man, Marvel Man, whatever you want to call them. And that will all be dissected. We've got trial notes. We've got quotes from the jury and the prosecution.
There is a script in the world, folks. This episode is coming, but it is essentially like a lot of legalese, a very complex tangling. And it's interesting. It shows you how complicated things can be do when you do business with a handshake and a smile, right?
And I love you checks.
Stuff like that. It's interesting, but that's essentially...
But a slight spoiler, neither of them come out looking great.
No, it's true. Which is actually, you know, like what do we say about mud wrestling matches, right?
Exactly, you both get covered.
But anyway, that really is the short version. That's why that they had that, they didn't reprint that issue number 9, which I think has never reprinted, I'm not sure.
It's out now.
It's in the collection.
It has a note.
Yeah, and sticky notes over all the three characters. They're cut out, they're just whited out. Now, talk about why they didn't print number 10. This is Todd versus Dave Sim. This really isn't as much of a feud. It really isn't a feud at all, but... Dave Sim wrote Spawn number 10. That was also May 1993. This is a strange dream story featuring his character Cerebus the Aardvark. The story in a nutshell is that Spawn is teleported to the 7th level of Hell, where comic creators are lined up to be executed and their creations are being held in prison. Very Dave Sim type story.
Very pretentious.
Exactly. And you know, all about creators' rights right off the bat. Mm-hmm. You know, he has 20-something pages and... Right to that same old well. But anyway, Cerebus calls to him and walks him through his own black and white world from his comic, and then back to Spawn's, where he reunites with his family. Now, McFarlane was one of the first publishers to make sure every issue of his series stayed in print, except for this issue. When asked, he simply said it doesn't fit into the Spawn storyline, which isn't much of an explanation, because like I said, it jumps around a lot. There are a lot of weird one-off issues in Spawn that have been reprinted plenty of times. It may have something to do with a few panels clearly showing some of Marvel and DC's popular characters' arms sticking out of jail cells.
Yep.
And they're really recognizable, too.
This it's obvious.
This is not a matter of, like, it's dubious. We're talking, like, I know I saw Wolverine's arm with the snicked and Green Lantern Spider-Man and everything. Spider-Man. I mean, there's no question. I'm feeling that has more to do with it. This issue would eventually be reprinted, though, in the Spawn Compendium 1, which includes the first 50 issues of the title. So
it's a very heavy book.
Goodness, yeah, that does sound like a thing. This issue was also nominated for Best Single Issue at the 1994 Will Eisner Comic Industry Awards. Nice.
It must have been the only book to come out in 1994. No, it's really quite a precious story. Yeah. It kind of gets stuck in your throat. Todd would have run-ins with another fellow by the name of Joe Quesada. Now, in an end-of-the-year column in Wizard Magazine in 2000, Joe Quesada wrote, "The first weeks as Marvel's EIC have been pretty interesting, but through the never-ending waves of groupies and hangers-on pounding at my door, I still ponder one question. Whatever happened to Todd McFarlane? What happened to the golden boy who reveled in his badassness and made his fortune on the backs of fans, retailers, and collectors, only to disappear in our industry's greatest time of need? Does he no longer care? Or is he just afraid to come back? Where is the Todd in his big yapping mouth? I'll tell you where. Home, wrapped in his MTV Music Awards and Spawn movie posters, saying, 'Please, Wanda, don't make me come back to comics. Everyone will see that I really had no clothes.'" Yikes. "Back in the good old days, Todd never had trouble calling anyone out to the mat. So if he can dish it out, I'm going to assume he can take it. I'm prepared to offer Todd McFarlane $1,000 to come back to the comics industry and draw. That's right, $1,000 cash. I'll go head to head with you, pencil to pencil. You do an issue, I'll do an issue. We'll let the fans, retailers, and collectors you abandon decide which book is better. Come on, toddler, what do you say? Wait, does anyone hear that? Buck, 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 ah! Sounds like Big Mac is in the house."
Wow.
What a jerk.
A very turn-of-the-century Joe Quesada statement, yeah. I would say. It's pretty much par for the course. Everything he was spouting at that time sounded like
that. And that was the biggest time of need in the industry.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we needed all of it. But, yeah, I'm sure. Anyway, let's talk about McFarlane's response. He responded almost immediately through his website. He wrote, "I believe that Joe does think that I can help contribute to the sinking comics market. As a matter of fact, he and I had a conversation recently that allowed us to both give some of our opinions on the current state of the industry. My biggest disagreement is that any book from my hand would have any real impact on the way the industry is sliding right now. The argument from his side is that we need to start someplace and continue to build upon it. I can hardly argue with the theory of that statement, but the implementation is the harder of the two. The truth is that we are all doing what we can to keep this business flourishing, all the way from Paul Levitz to the guys that color ad pages. No individual effort will matter in the long run, and that is what is far more important, because it is the short-sightedness of many of us that have led to this situation, and Marvel, being that king of the industry, had, perhaps, done more to hurt this community than anyone else. Their bankruptcy, attempted self-distribution, and many managerial changes have had a detrimental effect on all of us, albeit in an indirect way. So here's hoping that Joe is given the chance to bring some of his ideas to light. Good or bad, time must be given to those in charge. On a closing note, let me say that Mr. Q is a tad bit confused as to what makes me tick at times. One of the bigger reasons for leaving Marvel in 1991 was to have the freedom to do the thing that I wanted to do. I long ago stopped worrying about what some Marvel employee wanted me to do with my day. And so Joe's challenge is going to fall on deaf ears, just like every other thing that a competitor would like to see me do different. I'll do what I deem important after talking it over with my company and fans."
Very, very level-headed for Todd. It's almost as though he didn't write that.
Possibly. He didn't take the high road that time. But, you know, that was also a time that Quesada obviously is having his fun with $1,000 per page. That was nothing at all to McFarlane at the time. So I'm glad he went that route instead of lashing out and going nuts.
Sure, absolutely. Now, Quesada would try to bait him some more on the internet, but thankfully, Todd was not biting at the time. And this was all this, like, toddy boy.
Yeah, it went on.
Now, over the years, Quesada had made more and less jerk-faced overtures to Todd McFarlane, even suggesting that there could be a Spawn Spider-Man crossover, which I think a lot of folks would dig, but nothing's ever materialized.
Nope. That still is, well, now Quesada's out, right? So.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Oh, he's something else.
It's, yeah, he just changed his position. So
he's like the chief creative officer now or something.
Something like that. But now, more sports talk. In June 2003, McFarlane paid about $517,500 at auction for San Francisco Giants left fielder Barry Bonds' October 2001 record breaking 73rd home run ball. And there was actually a campaign to get him to shoot it into space. Do you remember this at all?
Yep, I do.
I guess it didn't happen. Now, speaking of, again, back to sports, Todd versus Tony Twist. In the Spawn comic book series, Todd McFarlane created a mob enforcer character named Antonio Tony Twist Twistelli. McFarlane acknowledged that he was named after left-wing position hockey player Tony Twist, who played for the Quebec Nordiques and the St. Louis Blues. And acknowledging that was a bad idea for Todd.
Pretty bad idea, yeah. Because Twist would go on to win a $15 million verdict in 2004 when a St. Louis, Missouri jury found that Todd McFarlane Productions had profited from Twist's likeness. The verdict was upheld after two appeals in June 2006, and in 2007, Twist and McFarlane settled the lawsuit out of court for $5 million. Yes. Loose lips sink ships. Yeah. Now, on July 21st, 2011, at San Diego Comic-Con International, McFarlane and Stan Lee debuted their new comic, Blood Red Dragon. The series is a collaboration with musician Yoshiki and stars a fictionalized version of him. In 2006, McFarlane and Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling formed the gaming studio 38 Studios, initially Green Monster Games, changed for obvious reasons.
I mean, McFarlane just likes to push those buttons, right? You know,
right?
I'm trying to come up with a new company called PepsiCo Products, you know, I'd be like, what's wrong with that, you know?
PepsiCo, Coca-Cola, yes. Warner Disney Brothers.
Right, exactly.
They did this in order to produce a role-playing game, produce role-playing games, actually. Actually, with McFarlane overseeing the art direction. In February 2012, the company released its only title, Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, a single-player action role-playing game that enjoyed pretty good success. It was a lot of fun too. You can Google Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning to find out everything that went on with this company. It's interesting and kind of depressing.
I remember the game when it came out. It did make some nice waves and for people to play those type of games.
Kind of like Fable, but on every platform. Now, by late May 2012, however, the company had ceased operation and they filed for bankruptcy. Personal life, Todd married his high school sweetheart, Wanda.
Yeah.
That happened in 1985, and they live with their three kids in my neighborhood, Phoenix, Arizona.
That's right. That's why you and the Toddster are hanging out, the toddler you call him as you're hanging out all the time, right?
Yes. Baby.
I got to say, that story with Wanda, it is very sweet. I did come across a lot of stories of he and his wife through the years. We don't do that kind of show here, really, so yeah. I left it out. We're really more about just the facts, ma'am. But,
Their daughter, Cyan, is actually Wanda. His daughter in the comic too.
Oh, really?
Wanda has a daughter named Cyan, and that's their actual daughter.
I mean, to me, these guys are living their best lives. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
The image guys, or at least
their own rules. Yeah.
I'm thinking of really Eric Larson and Todd, but also pretty much Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld and the rest of them. They have carved their path and they do what they want to do and love them for it. But most people today, I think, if you stop them on the street, told them who is Todd McFarlane, they would say, who are you talking about? But a portion of them would say that's the guy that makes the good toys, right? Really well known for his toys, his adaptations. We want to talk a little bit about that. But, of course, first, the way we do, we had to discuss the history of toys. And just want to say that this definitely could be and probably is its own long-running podcast. We're just going to kind of hit the high notes of the history of toys. Now, originally, there really wasn't such a thing as toys. There have been pole toys and puzzles that excavated from ancient Egyptian and Greek archaeological sites, but it's unclear if these were even meant exclusively for children. They could have even been to, do war you know, planning and stuff, move stuff around. And definitely for much of European history, working class children were expected to get to work and do little else than that. Then there was the Age of Enlightenment. This was an intellectual and philosophical movement that dominated Europe in the latter half of the 18th century, and actually kind of fomented the American Revolution at the same time. It professed to be a philosophy based on reason and advanced ideas of political and personal liberty. One outcome of the Enlightenment was that people started to view children as individuals instead of the property of a family or company. And as such, children were entitled to their own freedom.
You know, porcelain dolls, puzzles, and structured games were available to the children of wealthy families in the late 1700s. Rank-and-file kids were expected to play with whatever sticks and rocks were available in their yard. Now, the ones lucky enough to have yards, anyway. Now, still, children in general were afforded more time to be kids, to play, to have fun. And even a poor child could get some kind of street baseball or soccer game going. Then the Industrial Revolution. At the end of the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution made fabrication and mass production possible. And it must be said, new goods needed to be created to fill the idle time of new manufacturing machines. So we got toys, just like comics being the late night shift.
You see this happen throughout history. Yep. It's like the technology outpaces the demand for things, and we have to create the demand. And
we create leisure.
That's a whole other podcast about politics, but that's okay.
Now, at this time, playtime began to be considered as essential for proper childhood development. William Harbutt, an English painter, invented plasticine in 1897, and in 1900, commercial production of the material as children's toys began. Frank Hornsby was a visionary in the toy development and manufacturing, and was responsible for the invention and production of three of the most popular lines of toys based on engineering principles in the 20th century: Meccano, Hornby Model Railways, and Dinky Toys. Meccano is essentially the British Erector set, and may lay claim to being the first toy meant for the general public. It debuted in 1901. For the first 30 years of the 20th century, toys were primarily puzzles, teddy bears, and model trains, but nothing licensed from the very popular comic strips of the day. Until January 7th, 1929, the Buck Rogers and the 25th Century AD comic strip debuted, based on a serialized story by Philip Francis Nolan that ran in the sci-fi pulp magazine Amazing Stories during the 20s. The dailies were initially drawn by Dick Calkins and the Sundays by Russell Keaton, but this would change many times over the years.
Yeah, and, you know, I just want to say that plenty of comic strip stuff was licensed, but not for toys. Remember that was
not for toys.
They even had that Buster Brown line of shoes already existed.
The shoes, yep.
And I saw the yellow kid Ginger Snaps when I was looking online. There was stuff, but not toys. Toys were not really a thing. But Buck Rogers was an absolute sensation. The first Buck Rogers toys appeared in 1993, 4 years after the newspaper strip debuted, and a year after the radio show first aired. The best-selling toy was the Buck Rogers Ray Guns, a futuristic series of pistols that were modeled directly after the strip. There were actually four guns: the XZ-31 rocket pistol in 1934, the XZ-35 rocket pistol in 1935, and the XZ-38 disintegrator pistol in 1935. That's the iconic cigar-shaped one that probably looks like you would think all ray guns to look like. those three were actually all cap guns, but then there was also the XZ-44 liquid helium water pistol in 1936, so we had quite an array of weaponry for the kids.
Quite an arsenal.
This was the beginning of modern character-based licensed merchandising, and not only was the character's name and image branded on many unrelated products, but also on many items of merchandise unique or directly inspired by that character. They took the gun out of the comic and made it, and that was really the first time something like that had happened. Now we go to the first action comics figure, of course. Who do you think it was? It was Superman. That was released in 1940 by the Ideal Novelty and Toy Company and originally sold for 94 cents. This was made from a composition that's a mixture basically of sawdust and glue. With wooden joints, it stands 13 inches tall, and you couldn't find one for sale if your life depended on it.
No, I don't think so. We're going to jump forward here. Throughout the 20th century, dolls and action figures were made from a variety of materials, including increasingly better quality plastics as processes improved. By the end of the 1980s, there was barely a character in comics or cartoons that didn't have an entire toy line behind it.
Definitely. Yeah.
The 80s were a golden age.
Now, for somebody.
Now, going into the 1990s, toys outstripped their own marketing, which is how we got stuff like the Assault Gauntlet Batman and a whole line of Swamp Thing toys that had almost no bearing on the concurrently running cartoon that, you know, barely anyone watched anyway, so that was all right.
Yeah, but the toys outpaced the cartoon by a huge margin. I mean, goodness.
Totally. Yeah. Now, in 1994, Todd McFarlane was working with Mattel to produce action figures based on his comic book characters. When the two could not decide on how to make the toys to Todd McFarlane's satisfaction, he reclaimed the toy rights to his characters and started his own toy company. Like we said earlier, it was originally called Todd Toys. The name was changed in 1995 following pressure from Mattel, who feared that the company's name would be confused with that of Barbie's younger brother.
Yeah, who we all know off the top of my head is Todd. If that was a Jeopardy question, I would lose that day. Let me tell
you. Yeah, that would be a very sad day.
The first line of Spawn toys ever produced was released in 1994 and consisted of six figures: the hero Spawn and his medieval counterpart, aptly named Medieval Spawn, and beginning a host of trouble with Neil Gaiman, yes. With Tremor and the villains Violator, Overt Kill, and Clown, as well as a Spawn Alley playset, the Spawnmobile, and the Violator Monster Rig. Other toys utilized only a few colors painted in general areas, for example, like a single flesh tone for the face, and were tacked to cardboard backs. McFarlane's figures had individual items such as spikes, teeth, claws, and buttons painted individually, and packaged encased by a hard plastic that surrounded both the figure and the blister card, making them more suitable collector's items.
But hard to get out of the damn box.
Almost impossible. But that's, I think, a lot of people never have even tried. Each toy in the first line came with a regular-sized comic, although with fewer pages than the standard 22, which were individualized to the character. This is what really kicked off the huge toy collecting craze that still lasts today, in terms of the high-priced busts and limited-edition statues, not collecting old toys, but getting the new ones that come out. And these things, they go for... I mean, I saw a bronze Batman statue for $1,500 or something like that.
Aye, aye, aye.
Sold through DC. We don't mention it here, but Spawn toys kept cranking forever. I think they're on their 15th wave of.
Oh yeah, they're still coming.
So they're out there.
Now, Todd has been a longtime fan of the horror genre and decided to produce his own perspective on the classic monsters with Todd McFarlane's Monsters playsets. That happened in 1997, and they were Dracula with removable coffin and rotating hideout, Frankenstein, which included the Doctor and his namesake, plus a highly detailed Awakening rig.
That's right. The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which included the Hunchback and a hooded executioner, as well as a bell tower, and Wolfman, with a great wooded scene and a dismembered victim in a puffy orange hunting vest.
Now, the second series followed the following year, which had a two-headed Frankenstein, the Mummy, the Phantom of the Opera, and one based on the Creature of the Black Lagoon.
That's right, and they actually did interlock with the first wave, too, so it was like you kind of were building on this larger horror set. Yeah. McFarlane continued the idea of generating new versions of classic stories and characters, releasing a shocking line subtitled Twisted Land of Oz in 2003, which features vicious or sadistic versions of the wonderful Wizard of Oz characters created by L. Frank Baum. There have been two other series, the last containing a figure similar to Freddy Krueger from a Nightmare on Elm Street film series, which was not specifically necessary since 1998. McFarlane introduced the Movie Maniacs line of figures, and Series 1 began as a line of horror and science fiction-based figures that had been licensed from influential and financially successful film horror films such as A Nightmare on Elm Street, right there, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Friday the 13th. Two more series in this line followed.
Now, McFarlane Toys capitalized on the popularity of famous rock musicians with the release of figures based on the rock legends Kiss in 1997. Action figures were part of an overall marketing deal between McFarlane Toys and the rock band Kiss, with both toys and a comic book series based on their album Psycho Circus. I think Joe Casey wrote that.
Okay.
I never read it, but I'm pretty sure his name was attached to it. Now, release of new Kiss products from McFarlane continue to the present day. The second musical property that McFarlane released was based on the immensely popular pop culture icons, the Beatles, featuring figures of Paul McCartney, John Lennon, George Harrison, and the other guy. Ringo Starr appeared in their 1968 animated film, Yellow Submarine, as well as their appearance on the 1965 ABC cartoon show, also titled The Beatles, or commonly known to fans, and on McFarlane Toys' packaging of the figures as Saturday Morning Cartoon. Though no toys have been made to resemble these artists' actual likenesses.
Right.
Now, the number of music figures produced by the company continued to grow in number, diversity, and quality in the following years as they acquired the action figure rights to famous properties such as Rob Zombie, Alice Cooper, Ozzy Osbourne, Metallica, Slash from Axl Rose and the Band, Iron Maiden's mascot Eddie, Jimi Hendrix, Freddie Mercury, and Elvis Presley.
And also, you can bet McFarlane's Toys reflects Todd McFarlane's love of sports in the line McFarlane Sports Picks, which began in 2001. The line features popular figures from all five North American sports, baseball, football, basketball, hockey, and stock car racing. And McFarlane Toys holds licensing agreements with all these professional sports leagues. And we did consider starting to list some and then figured, wait a second, we're basically listing every athlete in America.
Just about.
So it's a lot, folks. And there's also a sports legends line within that line that features sports legends. And of course, this is from where, although this is not, I'm wrong about that. McFarlane Toys does figures for Simpsons, Lost, The Walking Dead, and some other television shows. And you know, Chris, I mean, it's unbelievable. This is definitely, you know, I think his biggest moneymaker. Seems to have devoted a lot of himself into it, but when you think of it, like the current trend for Funko Pops essentially comes from this. It's the idea that, you know, no one years ago said, oh boy, I can get an Alice Cooper toy, you know, or I can get, you know, I can get a toy for Lost, you know. But once McFarlane made those, he kind of opened the door for this like endless licensing of pop culture properties.
Well, properties, yeah, it's crazy.
And now you've got like Golden Girls, Funko Pops, and pretty much everything under the sun. So McFarlane really invented the current landscape for sure for collecting collectibles like that.
Yeah, and they're so impressive to look at too. Because like we were talking about that first line of Spawn figures in 94, 95, and those looked so much better than everything else on the market. But compared to current McFarlane stuff, they look like you can compare them to the old toys. I mean, they don't. He's improved so much, even from starting ahead of the game.
I mean, I don't know how he does it and still mass produces. Each one looks really finely hand painted. I got one in the. I told you this the other day that I got one in a late 19, you know, close to 2000, something like that. And it was a Spawn toy. I wasn't reading Spawn. I couldn't tell you. It wasn't Spawn. It was one of the characters from it. But I remember being so impressed with the high level of detail.
Oh, yeah.
The fragility of it, too. And I was like, this is not for a kid at all.
A kid ain't going to play with that.
A kid would turn this to garbage in about 5 seconds. plus, looking at the, you know, I've definitely seen all those horror movie ones and all the other ones and been super, super impressed. It's it's like a new thing for toys. And it affects all of them now. If you go buy whatever, Superman or
Batman DC toy, Direct or a Marvel Legends,
the musculature is going to be much more defined.
More articulation.
Exactly, yeah. It's
even and higher price.
Well, there's that. But if you also get the Funko Pop if you don't want the articulation. But it's quite a thing he's made here. And to be honest, I really think that Todd McFarlane's success story isn't in comics, it's in toys. By way of comics and by way of everything else he's done. He's basically an all-around success, if you had to ask me. I'm sure his parents are very, very proud, and they should be.
Yes, they should. Now, we do have some letters to wrap up today. We, our semi-regular segment of letter reading. It's been a few months. we're going to read one now from our good friend Jeremiah Jones Goldstein here. He writes, and this is going back to...
This would be October. Our Halloween podcast.
Yes, our Halloween episode. He writes to us, Chris Reggie. I finished the Sabrina podcast, and it was another excellent episode. I knew very little about the creators, and I really got a lot of the bios you did. I also enjoyed the history lesson on witch persecution and Archie Comics. I'd be very interested in a longer-form Archie Comics history, similar to the Charlton episodes, if you ever decided to do one. Those Charlton episodes were a couple of my favorites. I really enjoy Sabrina, as well as Afterlife with Archie and other Archie titles, with the exception of Riverdale. I do not love the TV show or the comic.
No.
The two horror
titles. I'm right with you there, Jeremiah. That's pretty,
there
pretty
you go.
Crummy.
Now, the two horror titles are my favorite, though, and because they were so good, I ended up getting into the regular Archie titles. I think the art in Afterlife is amazing and enjoy a good zombie story. Sabrina is fantastic. It is a great horror comic with super writing and art. When either of these comics come out, they're at the top of the reading pile. I just wish that they'd publish more of them. I think at some point, if you only publish a handful of issues a year, people will eventually lose interest. I agree.
Yeah.
I won't comment on the Adam Hughes, Betty and Veronica comic and its publication history. Adam Hughes, I think he's known for missing deadlines every now and again.
Yeah, maybe.
No, he says, he closes with, "Thanks for another great episode." And we thank you for listening, and we thank you for writing in, for
thank
sure.
Thank you very much, and I feel the same way. I'm, you know, I picked that Sabrina comic, that episode, and I really enjoy it, but I would tell anybody, just wait for the trade. It's not worth
yes.
it. It's ridiculous. I mean, I can't even remember the last one. I think it came out in July or something like that. And
wow.
The one for this winter that was supposed to, they were like, oh, the next will be on schedule. Nope, they're not on schedule. I don't know what it is.
And we'll try to do something about doing a full Archie Comics history.
Oh yeah, we've talked about that.
History.
And you know, Goldwater, or right, Barry Goldwater, that's the guy that started it. no, it's not right. What is it? Gold?
It's a Goldwater, but
it
not
is a,
Barry.
It's not Barry. I'm getting the name wrong.
He was the CCA head.
Exactly.
So
he figured
that's
really
gonna be interesting.
Into that. So yeah, there's plenty we can say about it, and that's. Definitely would take that into consideration. Now, the next one is from Mr. Aaron Head Moss. He says, "Hey, Reggie and Chris, just want to drop you a line letting you know I love your podcast. I found you when I saw a Facebook post about your crisis coverage. That would have been back in August from 50 to 55, right? Or 54?
50 to 54, yeah.
Yeah. I recently briefly covered the crisis as far as the Atom was involved. During my show, I gave you guys a reference. Since then, I've listened to some of your other shows, and I have to say, I love them. I think you guys are doing a great job. I'm about ready to cover Armageddon 2000 on my Head Speaks podcast. I plan on covering one or two books a month with other podcasters guest hosting, and he gives us an offer to talk about it, and we did accept, so hopefully
absolutely.
He will get us into that. He says, anyways, keep up the great work, Aaron Head Moss. And you can find him at stitcher.com/podcast/head-speaks. So, yeah, that's really cool. Definitely would love to talk about Armageddon 2001. Sometimes,
sure.
You know, we jam-pack these episodes with so much biographical and historical information, we don't even get to really talk about how we feel about these comics every time. You know, we just kind of like blast right through it and like more info. But I really, you know, do like before the show is when Chris and I often relax and say a couple of nice and sometimes not so nice words about the things that we are working on in comics. But if you've got some nice or even not so nice words to say about Spawn or Image Comics or anything that we've talked about in this episode, you can write to us at weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cosmictmailhistory. We're on Twitter at cosmictmail, and I'm on Twitter at Reggie.
I'm at Ace Comics.
You can find our weekly writings at weirdsciencedccomics.com. And I tell you every week, go check out Chris's personal blog, chrisisaninfiniteearth.com, where he reviews a different DC comic every day of the week. You've been really in this... turn of the millennium.
This one year later thing.
Yeah, the one year later has been your thing all week, and it's pretty, you know, it's a little all over the map, but as far as
yes.
quality goes, but great stuff. Great breakdown of every issue with lots of pictures. Then he gives his thoughts at the end. In fact, you want to know his thoughts about comics, that's where you go. Because he'll tell you a little personal story sometimes if it applies
sure.
or just what you thought of the issue, plus the ads at the end, which is something almost no one provides. And It's that in itself is like a interesting history lesson of comics, because when you put up the Bronze Age or even like ones from the 80s, you have all these, you know, whatever, you learn Kung Fu, buy a mongoose,
yep.
all that stuff. But then you get into later ones, it's like you get a bunch of house ads and, you know, maybe a video game.
And
it's like, it just shows you really like that by itself is such an interesting change in the industry. And we will talk about that change someday and why it happened that way. But,
oh, yeah, for sure.
That's going to have to be for another episode.
Yes. We also maintain the show blog at weirdcomicshistory.blogspot.com, where we do show notes. We'll link to some videos, link to some sound, link to anything that might have to do with what we're discussing.
Yep. But I think that's all we got from this week. Chris, got anything else for him?
We want to see your Todd toys. So if you have a collection of McFarlane stuff, let us see it. That'll tweet awesome. It to us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And if it's okay, but let us know. We'll throw it on the Weird Comics.
We'll throw it on the blog.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do want to see those, whether they're in box or not. Although obviously out of box would probably be sexier, you know, if you can.
Yes.
if you could set it up like those G.I. Joe toy commercials in the 80s with like rolling rocks and, you know.
We want to see you in your backyard on your belly.
I want to see drawbridges coming down. I want to see toothpicks used as arrows. I want the whole nine. Yeah, I would love to see that stuff. But that does do us for the Image launches. So we are taking, you know, as always, more and more suggestions for like comics or any comics that you like or, you know, whatever you think would be interesting for us to read. But if that's all we got for him, I think I'm going to tell him to keep it on the treadmill vengefully.
See ya.
In the afterlife, you could be headed for the serious strike. Now you make the scene all day, but tomorrow they'll be held to pay. Attentively, I mean about future calamity. I used to think the idea was obsolete until I heard the old man stamping his feet. This is a place where eternally applied to their body. Teeth are extruded and bones are ground and baked into cakes which are passed around.